From the dawn of the Viking Age, the family farm was the basic economic unit of Norse life. As farmers and herdsmen, they planted grains and vegetables during the short growing seasons and relied heavily on livestock. But peace in the Northland was coming to an end. The expanding Viking population needed more fertile farmland, and tensions boiled over. Inevitably, violence flared between the Viking clans. As the stronger attacked the weaker, raiders fell on farmers with axes, swords, and brutal violence. Land feuds erupted with utter lawlessness.
Basically, a king was a man who had a big farm. And he had his bonders, his farmers, and his slaves. And whenever he felt like going and attacking somebody else, he just got all his guys together and went off and attacked them. The Vikings would run into the village, grab everything they could, take off again. It's not terribly sophisticated, but very effective.
Some Vikings, however, set aside their differences and prepared to seek their fortunes elsewhere. The hands and tools that once shaped the crossbeams of barns turned to another task. Along the shores of the northern inlets, boats were built. Boats that changed the lives of these people. Viking longships. These extraordinary vessels, revolutionary in design, took history on a new course and launched an onslaught that dominated Europe and beyond for the next three centuries.
And then they become Europeans and set out to conquer all over the world and promote evolution of the white man. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, where it's an overcast day today, but it's warm. It's up into the 50s today. We're going to have rain all week. We need rain. Rain is good for the crops and so forth around here. And most people would prefer rain to snow, that's for sure. Well, let's see, what is it today? This is Thor's Day. Yeah. March the 10th, 2016. Thor's Day. Well, another big debate went down last night. I watched part of it. Bernie and the bitch. I call her a man. Hillary the man. Yeah, well, Bernie's got some really good points for the working class, as far as I'm concerned. However, he's got failings on the race issue. He's terrible. On the immigration issue, he's terrible. And he tends to be in awe a little bit of Hillary. He tries to be too much of a gentleman with her instead of understanding you can't treat Hillary like a gentleman would treat a lady. She's a bitch and should be treated like a bitch. And even though it was Telemundo, a Mexican television network, a couple of the people, or one guy on the panel who questioned, I thought did a good job. He wasn't taking any of her bullshit. Yeah. And they drug in a whole family of five of these little dwarfish Hondurans and a short, squat, bow-legged mama to whine about her husband is over here in the United States and they can't join up and they need to join up. And so Hillary and Bernie were saying, oh, we're going to let you all join up now. When I get in, we'll let you join up. No, they're not going to be any walls or nothing, man. These people are all your absolute deadly enemies. You got it? Deadly enemies. If you are a white racist separatist, if you're an Aryan person, or if you think Aryan, act Aryan, walk Aryan, talk Aryan, and so forth. Like I said the other day, you got to think white all the time, just like the blacks. Now you can learn something from the blacks whites have been dumbed down so much. Don't matter what your possibilities are as far as intellect and so forth, if you're too stupid to understand the laws of nature, then it doesn't make any difference how smart you are on other things. You can create an atomic bomb. Boy, what a genius. He created something to blow the shit out of everybody. Oh, what? Boy, that, now there's a white man that's really smart. Since the bombs are going to be eventually probably dropped on his own kids and grandkids. So what's smart about that? What's smart about destroying the environment and polluting the rivers and tearing all the mountains down to get a little coal and all that stuff? That's smart? No, that's stupid. So whereas a certain percentage of the population, of the white population, are genius and very smart, the rest of them are not too bright. In fact, they're stupid. They're stupid. And you got to recognize that. And when they endanger the environment and the air you breathe and the water you drink, like they do in Flint, Michigan, they're your deadly enemy. Deadly enemy. The governor of Michigan should be tried, and if convicted, executed, like they do in China. Yeah. White people don't seem to give a shit, but 38% of Flint is white. Do you see any white people out there with placards demonstrating? If I was closer, that I would. But they're all out there worrying about the niggers. We got to save the niggers because they might get some lead in their brain and not think too good. The only way they're thinking good is how to shaft Whitey. We're going to get the man. We're going to jive the man. The man is buying into all this shit, this liberal shit, this crap. Oh, it's unbelievable. I can watch a little of this stuff, but I am so sick and tired and fed up with most of the white race in this country and the world that I just have to sometimes walk away and think about something else. But the only thing that keeps me going is worse is better. Yeah, that keeps me going. Knowing that all this shit's going to fall apart, knowing this sham democracy, which is the worst form of government, is going to collapse because it flies in the face of nature and never will last forever. It only lasts for a while. This empire is crumbling. And I think what's going to happen is when it starts crumbling, it's crumbling slow now, but all of a sudden it's like an avalanche. The avalanche will start out with some breakaway of the snow, and then all of a sudden, bam, the whole damn thing comes down. That's what we're looking at here. We're pissing around at depression and inflation. Everything in the stores is getting higher. You notice that? Every time I go to the grocery store or any place for anything, hardware stores, a lot of things are doubling in price. Go to buy a simple drill for your drill motor, any kind of thing like that. Groceries, I think, are up about a third. And the white people are just, oh, well, what can I do about that? I can't do anything about that. I just got to act like a nigger and take it. Well, a lot of niggers don't take it. They just break the front of the fucking store down and take what they want. So who's stupid here? Who is stupid? These black radio guys, they keep harping on reparations. Well, I know there are a lot of them are very stupid, but a lot of them are very smart, because when they say white, it's inclusive. We're all guilty. We all did it. We all formed the corporations. We all screwed the poor people. Wait a minute. I didn't. My parents and my grandparents didn't do it. I apologize for bringing the niggers in here. in the first place and apologize for not sending them back after the Civil War, at least. I apologize for that, but I want them to apologize for us for screwing up our labor force and not going after the ruling class. We have nothing to gain by having anything to do with the ruling class who are banking most of their money in the Caribbean and Switzerland and all over the place. They don't give. They've never given a shit about the working class whites. And there's a hell of a lot more of us than there are of them. So tell your local nigger agitator, look, buddy, it was the capitalist planters that brought your people in here and changed, not us. We didn't have the power to do it. The poor people, in fact, there wasn't as much middle class back then. We didn't have the power. My ancestors were working class farmers. We didn't have the power to bring slaves anywhere. It was only the rich capitalist class, agri-capitalism. So tell them, look, if you want to go blame somebody and hang somebody and torch somebody and cut somebody's heads off, go to the ruling class. Those are the ones that did it to you. And now you are trying to spread it around like we did it. It's all us. Well, that ain't going to last, Rastus, I'll tell you that. You better get smart about who's your really, really big enemy and get it straight. Or you're going to get cut down in a race war. Sooner or later, you'll get cut down in a race war. Because there's not nearly enough of you to take on the bulk of the white race once they get their ass in an uproar. Once they come out of the barns with the pitchforks and the knives and the blunderbuss and the C4. Whoops, I shouldn't have said that. That's going to get me visited. Oh, man. I'm wound up today. Well, I did this radio show. I was invited on this white American radio show with this young man who's trying to do some good. And now I hear he's getting all kinds of flack from this Hollywood Nazis, the NSM. Leaders of outfits like that are very jealous of maintaining their authoritarian position. So I got a call from him late last night, and I guess they're really giving him trouble. They might even send a couple of those fat, pot-bellied, out-of-shape Hollywood Nazis down to visit him. Well, I don't think it would take too much to thwart that. Just a good old 12-gauge shotgun slug, and they'd be running for the hills. Anyhow, these people don't seem to understand me on the right. They sure don't. I criticize tactics and stupid activities of the right. I don't criticize intelligent right decisions by anybody and on the right. If they do the right thing and don't do stupid things, I won't criticize them at all. And it's not personal. I can't let it be personal. This fellow Shope up there with the NSM, I've never met the guy, don't know anything about the guy. I understand he's got sort of an interesting background, but I really haven't gotten into it. I have no personal axe to grind with any of these people. There's very few people I have a personal axe to grind. You know, just a few, a handful, actually, two or three. Harold Covington, that little ass, big fat asshole, and David Duke. Because I know the damage they've done to the struggle. And I know the damage they keep doing to the struggle. But otherwise, everybody do what you want to do. My friends are all lone wolves. They're independent. They do what they decide to do. And if they educate themselves correctly, they'll know exactly what to do. They don't need me telling them what to do. All I do is give some advice. So if the grand poopah of the NSM wants to make a big deal out of this, he's wasting his time, and he'll never win. He can come at me with everything he's got. He can't win. I'm a lone wolf. I take care of myself, and my friends take care of themselves as independent people. You think I'm going to take a bunch of guys out and roll around in the gutter with the Hollywood Nazis? I wasted enough time rolling around in the gutter with the goddamn Reds. Incidentally, it was mostly white Reds. I never was attacked by more than two or three niggers in a group of 50 Reds. So I, in Oceanside, California, when I was standing there making a speech in the middle of, we were surrounded by at least 100 of these screaming memes who'd been drinking. There's one black guy come up there right close to me, and he had a pair of boxing gloves. He was waving them in my face. Come on, man, box me, box me. Come on, man, box me, box me. The minute the first punch was thrown in that riot, that nigger was not to be found anywhere. He was long gone. You guys that are afraid of blacks, unless they get dogpile you or knife you in the back, catch you down some alley, you don't have to worry about blacks. In fact, most blacks are not going to bother you at all. I've been in the blackest areas of Chicago and all over the place. New York, I've been all over Harlem, walked around Harlem, appeared on TV shows at the in Harlem. No black ever attacked me. Not one. So why are all these whites so afraid of blacks? Anyhow, I'm not going to argue with people like Hollywood Nazis, because the very fact that they operate the way they do shows that they're just not quite up to par. They're not the brightest light bulb in the basket. But if any of them want to talk to me and ask me why I think the way I do, I'm always willing to talk to them. I don't automatically assume a white man is my enemy until he does something to prove it. So anyhow, that's the latest there. Got another debate tonight. The Trumpites against the against the demo crazies. No, it's against another stupid Republican. Cruz, that bastard. He is just such a phony. He was right. Thought he'd ride into office on the shirt tails of the evangelicals. Ha ha ha! He got a surprise when it came down to the wire of tough talk and getting something supposedly done. Trump totally trounced him. Totally trounced him. Those evangelical Christians, they can't hide their normal feelings. And all through the South, they come out for Trump. Well, why would they do that? He's not even talking about Jesus. Well, let me tell you, the Christian community is the biggest hypocritical group of people in the world. But when you peel the first layer away, they're just as racist and mean and ruthless as anybody else. But Cruz thought he could ride in on their shirt tails, that he'd be in by now. But Trump understands human nature. No matter whether he's legitimate or not legitimate, he understands human nature and he knows how to play it. And he's playing it all the way. He's making all these other people scratch where they don't itch. And that's the part I enjoy. Whether he's legitimate or not, I don't give a shit anymore. I'm not voting for any of these kind of guys. If he comes out and goes into Congress with a whip and whips them like the money changers out of the temple, incidentally, which never happened, couldn't have happened, there wasn't a Jesus. And the temples back there under the Hebrews were so full of military people, that's where the money was being traded. The temples were full of military guys. If this phony Jesus would have stood up, this little scrawny Hebrew, and tried to whip the money changers out of the temple, they'd have cut him down so fast he wouldn't have known what happened. People should study history and study biblical history and so forth. They'd find out a little few things. Even the Jews, even the Israeli intelligentsia professors and so forth and historians poo-poo almost all that Old Testament shit.
Thor, Norse god of thunder. A fearless warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor. Two arch enemies battle to the death. Thor, the thunder god, against a staggering beast. A giant snake who strikes with lethal force. It is man versus monster. Thor unleashes his deadliest weapon, lightning from his magic hammer, as thunder rocks heaven and earth. The myth of Thor is filled with these epic showdowns, heroic battles against creatures who threaten mankind.
Thor is the champion of the gods. He's the great fighter who can be brought out when something is really bad. You don't go to Thor for wisdom. Go to Thor because he's going to protect you against the evil monsters.
Tales of Thor's adventures provided escape from one of the bleakest periods in human history, the Dark Ages of the first millennium AD. It was a time when the Norse world, stretching from the British Isles to the Baltic Sea, was in turmoil.
It's an agricultural society where people were farming and surviving kind of at the very edge of how it was possible to survive because it was cold. It was the northern part of Europe. It wasn't around the Mediterranean where it was much easier to grow things. And it tended to be, from everything we can tell, quite violent.
War, famine, and death were daily facts of life on the desolate northern fringes of Europe. But the myth of Thor brought a sense of order to the chaos.
It was a religion of the countryside. Paganism actually is a Latin word that describes that, what the country people believe in. And paganism is not really well organized either. It's not like the Greek pantheon in the sense that it's very well organized and everybody knows whose responsibilities and who's more important than whom. It's very different.
The view of human life in that mythology was a fairly dark, a fairly stern one. Human beings didn't look forward to the kind of salvation in heaven at the end of time that's promised in the Christian stories. They had a kind of a darker, a more sorrowful view of life. People have to show great courage and hardiness in the face of enormous obstacles.
For inspiration, the people looked to Thor.
Thor was the quintessential hero. He was strong. Unlike some of the other gods, he was not deceptive. He was not treacherous. But he was steadfast. And as this hero figure, I think people could identify with him best.
In the myth, Two of Thor's weapons help him conquer evil forces. A belt that doubles his strength, and a hammer that shoots lethal bolts of lightning. No matter how far Thor throws his trusty hammer, it will return to him like a boomerang. And each time thunder roars, it means Thor's hammer has struck a giant.
Thor is the master of lightning. And this is not uncommon in other mythologies. The obvious parallel here is Zeus in classical mythology, who is the thunder god.
The thunder and lightning god is the protector god. He's the strongest fighter, so he has that capability that Zeus has, the thunderbolt, the hammer for Thor, that can destroy the bad guys.
Thor's myth begins with his birth to two all-powerful parents.
His father is Odin, the god of the heavens, and his mother is Jord, which is earth. And so, in a sense, he is of the sky and of the earth, which makes him the perfect god for Middle-earth, for Midgard, where humans are.
In Norse mythology, the world is made up of three levels, all represented in a form quite familiar to the ancient Norse. A tree.
They used to make housing that roughly resemble American teepees. And the entire view of the cosmos by the Old Norse was really based on that construction of housing. You had a center pole that would hold up the walls. It would have been the skeletal structure of the house. It would have been the skeletal structure of the cosmos. So the small representing the large. That's one of the reasons why trees become so very important.
In the mythical tree's highest branches is Asgard, the dwelling place of the gods. At the opposite end, beneath the roots, is a cool, dark realm.
Chapter 2, Iconoclastic. As far as sociology is concerned, we must either abandon our reason or abandon Christ. He is preeminently the prophet of unreason, the preacher of rabble rabies. All that is enervating and destructive of manhood he glorifies. All that is self-reliant and heroic he denounces. Lazarus, the filthy and diseased vagrant, is his hero of heroes. And Dives, the sane, energetic citizen, is his awful example of baseness and criminality. He praises the humble and he curses the proud. He blesses the failures and damns the successful. All that is noble, he perverts. All that is atrocious, he upholds. He inverts all the natural instincts of mankind and urges us to live artificial lives. He commands the demonetization of virtues that aggrandize a people and advises his admirers to submit in quietness to every insult, contumely, indignity, to be slaves de facto. Indeed, there is scarce one thought in the whole of his dicta that is practically true. O Christ, thou artful fiend, thou great subverter, what an amazing, heedless glamour thou hast cast over the world, thou mean, insignificant-minded Jew. Why is it that our modern philosophers are so mortally afraid to boldly challenge the inspired utopianism of this poor, self-deluded Galilean mountaineer? This preacher of all eunuch virtues, of self-abasement, of passive suffering. The sickly humanitarian ethics so eloquently rayed forth by Jesus Christ and his superstitious successors in ancient Judea and throughout the moribund Roman Empire are generally accepted in Anglo-Saxondom as the very elixir of immortal wisdom. The purest, wisest, grandest, most incontrovertible of all divine revelations or occult thaumaturgies. And yet, when closely examined, they are found to be neither divine, occult, reasonable, nor even honest, but composed almost exclusively of the stuff that nightmares are made of, together with a strong dash of Oriental legerdemain. Through 1,000 different channels, current politico-economic belief is dominated by the base communistic Kabbalah of the man of many sorrows. Yet as a practical theorem, it is hardly ever critically examined. Why is it that the suggested social solutions promulgated by Jesus, Peter, Paul, James, and other Asiatic cataleptics are accepted so meekly by us upon trust? If these men were anything, they were crude socialist reformers with misshapen souls, preachers of a new heaven and a new earth. That is to say, demagogues. Politicians of the slums, and out of the slums, nothing that is noble can ever be born. As agitators, Jesus and his modern continuators shall be exclusively considered in these pages. However, it must be distinctly understood that the spiritual and temporal in all cosmogonies are so intricately interwoven that it is almost impossible to completely divorce them. Like the Siamese twins, gods and governments are inextricably bound together, so much so indeed that if you kill one, the other cannot live. Hence the open or secret alliance that has always existed between the politician and the priest. Whatever their primitive purity or impurity, all operative creedal philosophies are essentially civil and military codes, police regulations. Religion is a power, a political engine, and if there was no God, I would have to invent one, said the great Napoleon. In letter and in spirit, Christianity is above all things a political theory and a theory that often takes the form of raging hysterics. Religions are the matrix in which public institutions are generally molded. This has ever been well understood by the dominant leaders of mankind, from Numa to Brigham Young, from Solon to Loyola, from Constantine to the lowest Levite hireling, who gets paid in dimes and cents for his unctuous mock dithyrams. 2. All ye are brethren. Are all men really brethren? Negro and Indian, black fellow, Kalmuck and Cooley, the well-born and the base-bred, beer-soaked loafer and hero-hearted patriot, belted chieftain and ignoble mechanic slave, pot of iron and pot of clay. What proof is there that the brotherhood of man hypothesis is in accordance with nature? On what trustworthy, biologic, historic, or other evidence does it rest? If it is natural, then rivalry, competition, and strife are unnatural. And it is proposed to prove in this book that strife, competition, rivalry, and the wholesale destruction of feeble types of men is not only natural, but highly necessary. Has brotherhood ever been tried upon earth? Where, when, and with what final result? Is not self-assertion nobler, grander, and more truly heroic than self-denial? Is not self-abasement but another term for voluntary vassalage, voluntary burden-bearing? Christ might well and truthfully have said unto his followers, "Come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden, and I will bind ye in unbreakable bonds and load you down like an ass between two burdens." The poor and ignorant were his first followers, the vagrants, the disinherited, shiftless classes. And to this very day, the poorer and more ignorant men and women are, the more eager are they to follow his religious ideals or the political millennialisms that are distilled out of his delusions. If we only lived as Christ lived, what a beautiful world this would be, saith all thoughtless ones. If we lived as Christ lived, there would be none of us left to live. He begat no children. He labored not for his bread. He possessed neither house nor home. He merely talked. Consequently, he must have existed on charity or have stolen bread. If we all lived like Christ, would there have been anyone left to labor, to be begged from, to be stolen from? If we all live like Christ, is thus a self-evident absurdity. No wonder that it is recorded, "Not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God chose the foolish things of the world, and God chose the weak things of the world, and the things that are despised." Nothing else would have anything to do with him. Christ was indeed the prophet of the credulous rabble during 3 years of active agitation, and it abandoned him in his hour of need. What always happens under similar circumstances. For the rabble is ever cowardly, ungenerous, suspicious, unfathomably base. It has never yet had a leader of commanding ability, either in peace or in war, that it did not ultimately desert or betray, i.e., if he did not take the precaution to make himself its master. After permitting Christ to be butchered, the mob thereupon set him up as their divinity and erected altars to his renown. Slaves, women, madmen, lepers, Magdalenes were the earliest Christians. And to this hour, women, children, slaves, and lunatics are the raw material of the Christian church. Primitive Christianity cunningly appealed to the imagination of a world of superstitious slaves, eager for some mode of escape that meant not the giving and receiving of battle strokes. It organized them for the overthrow of heroic principles and substituted for a genuine nobility based on battle selection, a crafty theocracy founded upon priestcraft, hellcraft, almsgiving, politicalisms, and all that is impure and subterranean. It is a doctrine at once disgraceful in its antecedents, its teachers, and in itself. Truly has it been called the fatal dower of Constantine, for it has suffocated, or is suffocating, the seeds of heroism. Both ancient and modern Christianism, and all that has its roots therein, is the negation of everything grand, noble, generous, heroic, and the glorification of everything feeble, atrocious, dishonorable, dastardly. The cross is now, and ever has been, an escutcheon of shame. It represents a gallows and a Semite slave swinging thereon. For 2,000 years it has absolutely overturned human reason, overthrown common sense, infected the world with madness, submissiveness, degeneracy. Truly there is a way which seemeth right unto a people, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. Sound the loud timbrel, o'er lands and o'er waves. The Israelite triumphs. The nations are graves. 3. Is the golden rule a rational rule? Is it not rather a menial rule, a coward rule, a best policy rule? Why is it right for one man to do unto others as he would have others do to him, and what is right? If others are unable to injure him or do good to him, why should he consider them at all? Why should he take any more notice of them than of so many worms? If they are endeavoring to injure him and able to do it, why should he refrain from returning the compliment? Should he not combat them? Does that not give them carte blanche to injure and destroy him? May it not be doing good to others to war against them, to annihilate them? May it not also be good for them to war against others? Again, what is good? Is it reasonable to ask praying animals to do unto others as they would be done by them? If they acted accordingly, would they, could they survive? If some only accepted the golden rule as their guiding moral maxim, would they not become a prey to those who refused to abide thereby? Upon what reasonable and abiding sanction does this rule rest? Has it ever been in actual operation among men? Can it ever be successfully practiced on earth or anywhere else? Did Jesus Christ practice it himself upon all occasions? Did his apostles, his sons of thunder, practice it? Did Peter the boaster do so when he denied him for fear of arrest at the campfire? Did Judas the financier when he sold him for net cash? Also, how many of his modern lip servants actually practice it in their daily business intercourse with each other? How many? These questions require no formal answering. They answer themselves in the asking. And here it must be remembered that the best test of a witness is cross-examination. Do unto others as you would have others do to you. No base of precept ever fell from the lips of a feeble Jew. It is from alleged moralisms of this sort and fabulous principles that our mob orators, our communards, revivalists, anarchists, Red Republicans, Democrats, and other mob worshippers in general derive the infernal inspiration that they are perpetually hissing forth. Even the subversive pyrotechnic watchwords of their Mephisto millennium are to be found in the Holy Gospels. Is it not written, "And God sendeth angels to destroy the people"? Behold, these men are the angels that he sends, politicians and reformers. 4. Love one another, you say, is a supreme law. But what power made it so? Upon what rational authority does the gospel of love rest? Is it even possible to practice? And what would result from its universal application to active affairs? Why should I not hate mine enemies and hunt them down like the wild beasts that they are? Again, I ask, why? If I love them, does that not place me at their mercy? Is it natural for enemies to do good unto each other, and what is good? Can the torn and bloody victim love the blood-splashed jaws that rend it limb from limb? Are we not all predatory animals by instinct? If humans ceased wholly from preying upon each other, could they continue to exist? Love your enemies and do good to them that hate you and despitefully use you is the despicable philosophy of the spaniel that rolls upon its back when kicked. Obey it, O reader, and you and all your posterity to the 10th generation shall be irretrievably and literally damned. They shall be hewers of wood and carriers of water, degenerates, Gibeonites. But hate your enemies with a whole heart, and if a man smite you on one cheek, smash him down. Smite him hip and thigh, for self-preservation is the highest law. He who turns the other cheek is a cowardly dog, a Christian dog. Give blow for blow, scorn for scorn, doom for doom, with compound interest liberally added thereunto, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, eye fourfold, a hundredfold. Make yourself a terror to your adversary, and when he goeth his way, he will possess much additional wisdom to ruminate over. Thus shall you make yourself respected in all the walks of life, and your spirit, your immortal spirit, shall live not in intangible paradise, but in the brains and thews of your aggressive and unconquerable sons. After all, the true proof of manhood is a splendid progeny, and it is a scientific axiom that the timid animal transmits timidity to its descendants. If men lived like brothers and had no powerful enemies to contend with and surpass, they would rapidly lose all their best qualities, like certain oceanic birds that lose the use of their wings because they do not have to fly from pursuing beasts of prey. If all men had treated each other with brotherly love since the beginning, what would have been the result now? If there had been no wars, no rivalry, no competition, no kingship, no slavery, no survival of the toughest, no racial extermination, truly what a festering hell fenced in this old globe would be. 5. Reverend Ferdinand M. Sprague of Chicago, who may be taken as a common specimen of the priest-politician, in a little pamphlet lately published entitled The Laws of Social Evolution, writes thus: "The sheet anchor of socialism, according to its ablest exponents, is the Holy Christian Religion. Its motto, founded on the precept, 'Love thy neighbor as thyself,' is 'Each for all and all for each.' Its working principle for the present is altruism. Nearly all the canonized fathers of the early Roman propaganda, most of whom, by the way, were slaves, freedmen, or eunuchs, advocated similar ideals. Even now, the anointed and sanctified head of the Catholic Church resurrects the same hoary old utopianism in a Jesuitic encyclical addressed to his flock. How suggestive of being shorn and skinned is that word, flock? Again, the epistle of James, who is known to have been Christ's full brother, killed by a special policeman's club in a street riot, has been reprinted and widely circulated by socialists in order to sow and broadcast their illogical theories of a universal brotherhood founded upon enforced labor, regimentation of the herd, and majority votes. Many modern cities are also infested with plausible epileptoid priestlings of unreason, like Dr. McGlynn, Professor Bemis, Hugh Price Hughes, W.T. Stead, Myron Reed, and Professor Heron of California. All these men are unrivaled masters in the art of persuasive declamation. They accept the New Testament as their textbook and preach therefrom to morbid multitudes the atrocious and shallow gospel of equal rights, equal liberty, equal brotherhood, as the veritable omnific word, the newly discovered emancipating protocol of the crucified yet almighty Don Quixote, the savior god of Asia Minor, who was born in a cattle shed and died on a gallows. 6. A god begging his bread from door to door. A god without a place to lay his head. A god spiked to two pieces of crossed scantling. A god stabbed to death by an hired officer. A god executed by order of a stipendary magistrate. What an insane idea. Is it an idea or rather a wasting cranial disease? Talk about the heathen in his blindness and superstitious madness in past ages. Why, it is as child play to the hysteric idolatry of today, the deification of a Jew. The divine democrat was executed upon a government gibbet because the rulers of Imperial Rome were more powerful men than he was. His strength and that of his followers was not equal to theirs. He died an abysmal failure, a redeemer who did not redeem, a savior who did not save, a messiah whipped like a calf, a slave agitator deservedly destroyed for preaching a falsehood, the monstrous gospel of love, brotherhood, equality. Even from the spiritual point of view, there is nothing whatever in his life or in its after effects to show that the pale man upon the cross, when he moaned and wept so bitterly, beheld any further down the void than those who gathered round to see him die. Of what use was that pale dreamer to the iron conditions that existed in the conquered and garrisoned fortress of Jerusalem? For once the city mob were on the right trail when they petitioned for the release of Barabbas rather than the supple singer of a sweet by-and-by. Barabbas is described in the scriptures as a petty thief. He was really an armed insurgent leader, the slayer of Roman tax gatherers, a guerrilla chief like Rob Roy, Robin Hood, William Wallace, William Tell, who levied toll upon opulent Hebrews for patriotic purposes. Had I been there that day, I also would have joined in the demand, "Release Barabbas unto us." Better one Barabbas than 1,000 Christs. Alas, alas, O Galilean, thou art neither the way, the truth, nor the light. 7. Reverting, however, to Chicago's reverend utopia constructor, thus waileth he with cajoling crudity, "The laws of social evolution, far from being the blind, barbarous, and brutal struggle for organic existence, consists in the physical, intellectual, and moral well-being of all the members of society, so constituted that the political, ethical principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity shall have the largest possible realization throughout the social organism. The main features of the condition of progress are Christian churches, Christian schools, Christian governments, Christian ethics, and economics." Another seductive but most malignant state socialist, Henry George, roundly proclaims that "the salvation of society, the hope of the free and full development of humanity, is in the gospel of brotherhood, the gospel of Christ." And thereupon he proposes to make politicians the national rent tax collectors, administrators of everything in general, and all-round distributors of state pensions to the poor and needy. Has not mankind had sufficient experience of what politicians are? Those black-hearted creeping thieves and frauds, their sting is deadlier than the bite of a cobra, and in the breath of their mouth there is death. Curses be upon ye, O ye politicians, and upon all who advocate increasing your prerogatives. Presidential candidates from Jefferson to Lincoln, also their apish imitators, have generally indulged in equally shallow rodomontade because it means votes, and for votes office seekers would dress up in glowing language and rave forth any devilish deception. For 2,000 years, these effeminate superlatives have been trumpeted to the remotest corner of every Christian land, and yet, while enervating the moral of people, they have dismally failed to inaugurate that much foretold earthly paradise. They were preached by barefoot monks at the inauguration of the Dark Ages in order that those saintly lovers of the common people might creep into the administration of cooperative wealth and power. Now, the same general ideas are revived and dressed up, this time in politico-economic garb, by the eloquent agitator in order that he may rule and plunder in the future through the urgency of the state. Just as the priest once ruled and plundered through the equally rapacious agency of the church, when the church triumphed, the Dark Ages began, and when it is finally rooted out, together with all its social antennae, the heroic age dawns once more. True heroes shall be born again as of old, for our women may yet be something more than rickety perambulating dolls and drugstores and spectacles. The church is the idol of the priestly parasite. The state is the idol of the political parasite. Beware, O America, that in escaping from the holy trickery of the monk, you fall not an easy prey to the loving kindness of the politician. Even if the reformer succeeds in reestablishing, upon majority votes, the dark tyranny of the greatest number, we have this consolation to fall back upon. Such organization must ultimately tumble down of its own weight and then redivide up into warring fragments. Nothing that is unnatural can last for long. The universal church is no more. All we see of it now is jealous remnants, and the universal state, the social democracy, the economic republic, the brotherhood of man, should they take practical form, are preordained to similar failure. All they could do would be to postpone the operation of the survival of the fittest, drugging nations in temporary sedatives. No matter how eagerly madmen may try to do it, there is no known process whereby they can jump out of their own skins. Christian or socialist churches, paternalism, schools, governments, administrations, ethics, and moralisms, even if genuinely Christian and fraternal, would be wholly impotent to change the natural course of things and therefore powerless to command the survival of mental and physical cripples. Even although those cripples were as canonized saints for goodness and as the sands of the seashore for number, shrieking sentimentalism is indeed a feeble lever wherewith to overturn the immutable order of the universe. It cannot do it. No, not if it were whooped till the crack of doom. Not even if it had a Lamb of God in every city, ready to be butchered each Friday afternoon in order to make a Christian holiday. 8. Liberty, equality, fraternity, those three great lights of modern democracies, are three colossal falsehoods, ignoble slave shibboleths, impossible of actualization even if proclaimed by some superhuman Satan, followed by armed hosts of unkillable demons, all armed to the teeth with flaming swords, Greek fire, and dynamite cannon. You may trace equality in letters of silver on tablets of burnished gold, but without engineering a perpetual miracle, you cannot make it true. You may write fraternity in blazing diamonds on walls of enduring granite, but without reversing the mechanisms of the universe, you cannot make it a fact. And though you inscroll freedom on countless sheepskins and rivet statues of liberty on every harbor rock, yet with all the king's horses and all the king's men, one being born to be a hireling and a subordinate, no power can free. Can you build up a marble palace with mud and slime, O ye driveling bedlamites? Can you raise up a conqueror from the dunghill, or make the stupid great? Can you manufacture heroes out of hogs, O ye snuffling, educated swine? We can, we can, we can, shrieketh the raging rhetoricians of the marketplace and the editorial mill. We can, bellows the herd as it stupidly pours through the slip rails in the pithing pen. Yes, oh, yes, with the love of Jesus and our collection plate, whines the soft-skinned preacher as he turns over the sibylline leaves of his black art. Of a certainty we can, hisseth the plastic politician, the rattlesnake, the hungry basilisk, whose law making it more blighting than the breath of a simoom. Thereupon, toward you, O America, they, one and all, point the finger of pride towards you, America, where the politicians rage and the people imagine vain things, and the dogs in the alleys are baying at the moon. Then turn I away, sadly, 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 and I brush against a slave in copper riveted overalls, hurrying to his mill, and against another in gold chain and silken hat, hasting to his money changing, and a lean woman in sordid rags with a pile of lumber balanced upon her crown, and a splendid harlot in diamonds and brilliant plumage rideth slowly by, and the cattle in the slaughter yard are lowing for their hay, and a draft mare with a galled shoulder lieth swollen and dead on the frozen paving block. How nauseous it all is! Loathsome, loathsome, oh, how loathsome! 9. Man is part and parcel of the animal kingdom, and notwithstanding Jefferson, Franklin, and Lincoln, Karl Marx, LaSalle, and Leibniz, Christ, Robespierre, and Rousseau, Hinman, Tennyson, and Mazzini, Dr. Adler, Beeble, George and Isaiah, Bellamy, Gronlund, and W.T. Stead, he cannot escape from the draconic ordinances that despotically govern that kingdom and environ his being like an atmosphere on every side. Altruism, meek and lowly self-abnegation upon any extended scale is among predatory organisms, and all organisms are predatory, impossible of practice on pain of wholesale felodesse. Every man is under an obligation to fight and bear his own burden. If he cannot do so, others cannot do his fighting or his burden-bearing, and their own at the same time with reasonable safety to themselves. He, therefore, who finds it impossible to carry his own burden, had better sink down and die in his tracks than impose an additional load upon the shoulders of his kind-hearted fellow strugglers. For then they would be overloaded and consequently unable to fight successfully. So all might perish together. Practical fraternal sympathy upon any universal scale has always had in the end a most destructive effect upon the intended structure of communities. Men will always love and cherish those that are near and dear to them, but when it is proposed to extend the circle of that near and dear ones to all mankind, that is going rather too far. Indeed, all must perish ignominiously if that foolish idea prevails. All are even now enervating themselves, undermining their strength by futile overexertion in that very direction. They are straining themselves to death by endeavoring to carry an impossible load. The majority of men are born far too weak constitutionally for their conditions, and the few who do possess the necessary stamina and grit will have quite enough to do in proving by deeds their fitness to survive, propagate, and possess. Many are projected, few are selected. Yet altruism, wholesale self-renunciation, wholesale burden-bearing for the sake of outraged and suffering humanity is the maddening basis upon which our good Lord Jesus and his demented imitators have erected their sporadic sociology, their magnificent Satanism. Does not simple business acumen whisper to us that every man's chief occupation upon earth is to sustain himself? I mean, subsist at any cost. You shall want ere I shall. Business is business. If men had sufficient personal initiative to think along these stern lines, there would be little use on earth for the theologian and the reformer, those twin Mephistos who find their renown and grandeur in the abasement of mankind. The battle of life would then be so grim, terrible, and realistic, so Trojan, in fact, that those holy dissimulators and crafty deceivers would rapidly die off or be eaten off. For in the clash of naked interests, the best and bravest only could possibly survive. And no one would ever dream of including them among the best or bravest. 10. Count Leo Tolstoy, undoubtedly the ablest modern expounder of primitive Christliness, in a much translated volume entitled Work While Ye Have Light, writes thus, "Our faith tells us that bliss is to be found not in resistance but in submission, not in riches but in giving everything away. We have not quite succeeded in casting off every habit of violence and property." To the most inept understanding, could any proposition be placed in a clearer light? Is it not as simple as rolling off a log that the individual who even attempts to become a true and honest Christian must become like unto a tame sheep? What a sublime ideal! How heroic! The bliss of a sheep! How superlatively delightful! How divinely glorious! And a Jew is the good shepherd, who leadeth his lambs to green pastures and quiet resting places, the pleasant waters by. For 2,000 years or so, his fleecy flocks have been fattening themselves up with commendable diligence for the shearing shed and the butcher block. Let any nation throw away all habits of violence, and before long it must cease to exist as a nation. It will be laid under tribute. It will become a province, a satrapy. It will be taxed and looted in 1,000 different ways. Let any man abandon all property, also all overt resistance to aggression, and behold, the first sun will scarcely have sunk down in the west before he is a bondservant, a tributary, a beggar, or a corpse. Property is necessary to the complete and free development of personality, and therefore human animals should somehow obtain a full and fair proportion thereof at any cost, or perish in the attempt. For he who cannot possess himself of property is much better buried out of sight. Our cities are literally honeycombed with treasure caverns, heaped up with gold, title deeds, silver, and instruments of credit. Our valleys and our mountains are bubbling with wealth untold, and yet poor, miserable servants of Christ pass idly by. Men, they call themselves. I call them castrates. If Tolstoy's obsequious principles are derived from the Sermon on the Mount, then who can deny but that the Sermon on the Mount is a sermon unto decay and slavery? If they are derived from the Golden Rule, and if the Golden Rule is the Word of God, then can it be doubted that the Word of God is the Word of fraud? There is far too much of this ghastly goodness in the nation, far and away too much. It is time men who can think began to emancipate themselves and consider the fact that morals, laws, and decalogues were made by liars, thieves, and rogues. All good citizens, however, are hereby warned and solemnly advised not to smash up the Ten Commandments, not to burn up the Golden Rule, not to break up the moral law, for that would be terribly wicked, terribly. On the other hand, they must obey all law implicitly, no matter how it originated, and be sure, above everything, to order themselves lowly and reverently before executive officers of the law. Even if, in doing so, they are deprived of their property and their liberty forever. Obedience, you see, is of God, who so loveth the world. But disobedience is horrible and of the devil, and the devil is a frightful rascal who has not the slightest respect for anybody or anything, not even the American Constitution. Let us curse the devil then and obey the law. Liberty is honestly definable as a state of complete bodily and mental self-mastership, which includeth Liberty is honestly definable as a state of complete bodily and mental self-mastership, which includeth the possession of property, also defensive weapons, and thoroughgoing independence from all official coercion or restraint. Liberty, in the conventional sense, is a miserable lie. To be independent is synonymous with proprietorship. To be propertyless and unarmed is the condition of actual dependence and servitude. Unarmed citizens are always enslaved citizens, always. Liberty without property is a myth, a nursery tale, believable only by babbling babies and fools in the forest. Fools in the city also. Liberty regulated by law is, in practice, tyranny of the darkest and foulest description, because so impersonal. There are numerous worthy, reasonable, and practical methods whereby individual tyrants may be removed. But a tyranny regulated by law is only removable by one method. The sword in the hands of men who are not afraid to use it, or to have it used against them, that is to say, the sword in the hands of the strongest. During the whole course of human history, there is not upon record one authentic instance wherein a subjugated people has ever regained property-holding liberty without first butchering its tyrants or its tyrants' armed slaves in battle, thereafter confiscating to its own use the lands and realized property that previously had been in the possession of its defeated foes and masters. This statement is made with cool deliberation and aforethought. Let it be disproved by any one creditable example of the contrary, and the author is prepared to forfeit 50,000 ounces of pure gold and enough dimes and dollars to erect in Chicago a bronze statue of Our Blessed Redeemer, crown of thorns and all, 100 cubits higher than the Masonic Temple. This offer is strictly bona fide and shall remain open till 1906, so that philosophers, editors, statesmen, divines, and other accomplished liars may have enough time to bind themselves wading through national archives and the putrid rubbish heaps that men call public libraries. Should some or all of said mutual admiration society maniac geniuses go blind, Also deaf, dumb, and silly, this wicked old world may probably whoop with delight, should it happen to hear of the fact. 11.
Well, that's most of Chapter 2 of Might is Right, and this is terrific stuff. Much easier to listen to than to read. I'll tell you, it's changed my mind about a lot of things. I think I'd better take that idea of Aryan socialist apart, leave the socialist away. The term socialist, I think, is almost as bad as the term capitalist. Oh, I'll be back with you tomorrow with another segment of Might is Right and some other things, too. 14:05. And this is the, the 10th of March, 2016. After listening to that information, don't you see how silly it all is? How silly all this bullshit around us is? And how correct George Carlin is.